From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
It was a busy week at the Supreme Court. The justices heard oral arguments in two high-profile cases over guns and the internet, and they decided to take up Donald Trump's bid for immunity from criminal prosecution, putting his election interference trial on hold until the court makes a decision, perhaps as late as June. Trump's litigation strategy of delay, delay, delay essentially gave him a victory. Here's former federal prosecutor Robert Mintz.
One tactic in any defense team's playbook is to try to delay. Here we've seen that done again and again by former President Trump's lawyers, and it has special significance here given the fact that there is an upcoming election. And so the decision here as to whether and how quickly Mr. Trump could go to trial is especially critical because it could not only affect his election prospects, but should he be reelected, it would actually affect the Department of Justice's ability to bring this case at all, since once he's president, he could simply direct his attorney general to dismiss the case that was pending against him. So it has particular significance.
And like everything related to Trump, that decision seemed to overshadow the cases the court heard this week. On Monday, during almost 4 hours of arguments, the justices grappled with the new Republican-backed laws in Texas and Florida that ban social media platforms from removing content based on the views expressed.
This is such an odd case for our usual jurisprudence. It seems like your law is covering just about every social media platform on the internet. And we have amici who are not traditional social media platforms, like smartphones and others who have submitted amici brief, telling them that readings of this law could cover them.
And several justices echoed the concerns of Justice Sonia Sotomayor about how the very broad laws might affect other sites like Uber, Etsy, and Venmo. Here's Justice Amy Coney Barrett.
So Florida's law, so far as I can understand it, is very broad. And we're talking about the classic social media platforms. But it looks to me like it could cover Uber. It looks to me like it could cover just Google search engines, Amazon Web Service. And all of those things would look very different. And, you know, Justice Sotomayor brought up Etsy.
Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas appeared most ready to embrace arguments made by lawyers for the states, characterizing social media's content moderation as censorship.
Is it anything more than a euphemism for censorship? I want to just ask you this. If somebody in 1917 was prosecuted and thrown in jail for opposing U.S. participation in World War I, was that content moderation?
Joining me is Eric Goldman, co-director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University Law School. Eric, justices on both sides of the ideological spectrum were concerned about how broad these laws are and how they could cover sites from Etsy to Gmail.
Essentially, what Florida and Texas did is that they passed laws that were packed with over a dozen different ideas in each. And because of that complexity, it makes it very hard to determine who's actually covered by the law and what they're expected to do. And based on the way that the cases got to the Supreme Court, some of that wasn't fully clarified at the lower levels. And so the justices were just wrestling with the indeterminacy of the law, that they couldn't figure out who's covered, what it would actually require them to do. And therefore, they didn't even know how to evaluate the constitutionality of those provisions.
There were also a lot of questions about whether social media platforms should be treated like common carriers, such as telephone companies. So are tech companies more like publishers or public utilities?
I think that the real struggle was in how to interplay a speech restriction, of which the laws contain several, with other legal principles like public accommodations, the idea that companies should not discriminate against their customers based on certain protected attributes. So other concepts like common carriage or public utility doctrines, those kinds of doctrines could be in play. But the real struggle is that the court doesn't really know how to think about how social media services differ from, say, a restaurant. Until they get to that basic understanding of the different functions of social media services, they don't even know how to categorize them.
And early in the arguments, Justice Kavanaugh emphasized to Florida Solicitor General that the First Amendment only prevents governments from restricting speech, not private businesses.
In your opening remarks, you said the design of the First Amendment is to prevent suppression of speech, end quote. And you left out what I understand to be three key words in the First Amendment, or to describe the First Amendment, by the government.
That seemed to be such a strong point, but then it just disappeared from the arguments.
Justice Kavanaugh really hammered that the First Amendment restricts how governments act, not how private actors act. And when the government tries to tell publishers how to act, that's a facial, unambiguous First Amendment violation, no questions about it. And for some reason, he was pretty much the only voice making that point. Even though it seemed so screamingly obvious, all the other justices were struggling to get back to that basic point. And so that makes me nervous, because Justice Kavanaugh was 100% correct in that observation. And he was almost like a lone voice on it.
I thought coming into these arguments that there was no way they would uphold either of these laws. Now I'm not so sure.
Well, it's not a binary question. It's not, do the law survive or the laws fail? It could be that parts of the law survive and parts of the law fail. Like in the 11th Circuit, some of the laws did survive and other parts did not. So the Supreme Court is quite likely to try to make some distinctions about the different provisions and will be careful to try and make sure that whatever they say on any of those provisions wouldn't affect some future legislature's freedom on different topics. So the net effect is that it's possible that some parts of the law will survive. And that's scary to me, because there was really no salvaging the law at all, either law. Both of them were so misguided at their core that the idea that any piece of the law might be okay is really just horrifying to me.
Well, if parts of the laws are allowed to go into effect, that means we could have a landscape across the country where different states have different rules about social media?
That's inevitable. That's already happening today. And that's a different question for the court that they acknowledged occasionally, but weren't prepared to deal with. It wasn't within the scope of their review. But the entire idea of individual states coming up with their own version of a social media service and how they regulate it just completely contradicts how we think about the internet and really how internet law can function in a meaningful way. So, you know, just to be clear, there are provisions of both the Florida and Texas laws that were not challenged, that are in effect today, that the states have chosen not yet to enforce. So we are already living in a world where parts of these laws are in effect, and whenever they're enforced, if ever, we could see a radically different internet. The states are not likely to deploy those laws to advance the interests of the internet at large. They will do so to advance the voters they're trying to impress.
Yeah, at one point there was a discussion about whether Texas could be geofenced out.
Yeah, it's the weirdest message. The Texas lawyer basically said to get the F out of Texas if you don't want to follow their rules. And if I'm a Texas social media user, I'm going to be quite concerned about that position. They're basically begging the social media service to change the internet for Texas. And I'm pretty sure that's not actually what Texas voters want.
These cases are just at the preliminary injunction stage. So could the justices just send this back, you know, for trial and for more findings of fact?
That's the best case scenario for the social media services, is that the Supreme Court keeps the injunction in place, or in the Texas case, restores the injunction that was initially issued, and then sends it back to the trial courts to determine whether or not a permanent injunction is appropriate. That's the best case scenario. That step would have to happen no matter what, if the law is going to be struck down. But if the courts decide to affirm some or all of the existing laws, they could simply say injunction dissolved, laws go into effect, and either the social media services can never challenge it because they'll have no merit, or at best, the social media services will have to challenge only after they've been sued under the law. And clearly, social media services don't like that answer because of the fact that they would then have to build a compliance function and hope that they got it right, or risk really quite devastating remedies. So the best scenario is that we have further proceedings in this case at the lower court to determine the permanent injunction. And the worst case scenario is that the laws go into effect as they're currently written, with the possibility of limited further challenges.
And how do you think the justices are going to line up?
It wouldn't surprise me if three justices would vote to support the Texas and Florida laws. That could be done substantively, or more likely on a procedural basis, simply saying that they reject the facial challenge. That was Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Gorsuch. After that, the other six justices were kind of all over the map. I heard some reservations about the laws and the likelihood that some aspects were unconstitutional, but I couldn't tell then if that would support a procedural ruling on the legitimacy of the facial challenge, or if there were substantive agreement about which of the pieces were going to be unconstitutional. So I come away from the oral argument really uncertain about the future of the cases, and also, frankly, uncertain about the future of the internet.
There's certainly a lot at stake here. Thanks so much, Eric. That's Professor Eric Goldman, co-director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University Law School. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, the justices appear split over whether to uphold the federal ban on bump stocks. And two justices from opposite ends of the ideological divide make a public appearance together. We'll tell you why. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
The Aikens accelerator, the original bump stock, shot at 650 rounds a minute, and the devices at issue here are represented to shoot between 400 and 800 rounds a minute. So right in that range with the M16, the M14.
Brian Fletcher, representing the Biden administration, explained to the Supreme Court justices on Wednesday that bump stocks turn semi-automatic rifles into weapons that fire at speeds comparable to machine guns, like the M16 and M14s used by the military. The question is whether the justices will strike down a ban on bump stocks that was imposed by the Trump administration after the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history in Las Vegas in 2017. The liberal justices, like Elena Kagan, seem to think that the 100-year-old law banning machine guns could also cover bump stocks.
The entire point of this device is that you exert forward pressure and you have your finger on the trigger, and then a torrent of bullets shoots out. So I don't understand why it's any different.
It is different
from pushing a button and holding the trigger, pushing the barrel and holding the trigger.
But conservative justices like Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch, while seeming to acknowledge the danger of bump stocks, question whether banning the devices was up to the court.
It seems like, yes, this is functioning like a machine gun would. But, you know, looking at that definition, I think the question is, why didn't Congress pass that litigation, I mean, that legislation to make this covered more clearly?
I can certainly understand why these items should be made illegal. But we're dealing with a statute that was enacted in the 1930s. And through many administrations, the government took the position that these bump stocks are not machine guns.
Joining me is Andrew Willinger, Executive Director of the Duke Center for Firearms Law. Andrew, start by giving us a little bit of the history of the federal ban on bump stocks.
So this is an ATF regulation that categorizes bump stock devices as machine guns under the National Firearms Act. And so, therefore, those devices are banned. This regulation was promulgated after the 2017 Las Vegas shooting, the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, where the shooter used bump stocks. And after that shooting, there was some discussion about whether Congress might act through legislation to specifically say that, you know, bump stocks are prohibited or bump stocks are machine guns. And ultimately, that did not happen. Instead, the ATF under the Trump administration promulgated this regulation. And, you know, it's, I guess, worth noting here that the ATF has sort of had in the previous decade or so gone back and forth on how it categorized them in informal guidance to the industry, these sort of letters that the ATF would send to companies that were making bump stocks, occasionally saying that some of these devices were not machine guns and could be produced and sold. And so this regulation in 2018 kind of settled that matter. But again, it's the culmination of a little bit of a back and forth from the ATF.
So this isn't about the Second Amendment, then. It's about the reach of this federal statute and how the ATF interpreted it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit complicated. It's not, I guess, to start.
It's a lot complicated.
Yeah, the justices certainly, I think, are struggling with this one as well. So to start, you know, you're right. It's not a Second Amendment case. That's been pretty clear from the get-go. This is really, as I see it at this point, really a pure statutory interpretation question. And then the question is whether the ATF's interpretation of machine gun to include bump stocks was in accord with the statute, with what the statute means, what the intent was when the statute was written. So for that reason, the arguments that we heard were really focused on just this question of what does the relevant statutory language, single function of the trigger automatically, what do those words mean?
I have to say, I found these arguments so confusing, with the justices seeming to struggle over the technical aspects of bump stocks, over, you know, are you pushing a button? Are you pulling? Are you exerting pressure on it? Why was that important?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of confusion, a lot of hypotheticals, you know, revolving around buttons and tripwires and those types of things. But I think ultimately the issue sort of reduces to the perspective from which you view this phrase, single function of the trigger. So the government's argument really just boiled down is that single function of the trigger really means single pull of the trigger. So you're focused on the act of the shooter and what the shooter does in pulling the trigger, and that because that pull of the trigger initiates the bump firing sequence when you're using a bump stock, that therefore the gun is firing multiple rounds with a single function of the trigger. Cargill, on the other hand, says you don't look at this from the perspective of the shooter. Instead, you're looking at the actual mechanical function of the trigger. What does the trigger of the gun do? And the way, again, according to Cargill's argument, the way that that works is that when you are bump firing a semi-automatic weapon, the trigger still has to go back and forth. And only one round is expelled each time the trigger goes back and forth. It just happens very quickly.
The court's liberals seem to suggest that bump stocks fell within what Congress intended when it banned machine guns. And particularly Justice Elena Kagan went at this over and over again with Cargill's attorney and, you know, appeared incredulous that a weapon that can fire a torrent of bullets could not be defined as a machine gun.
What I detected from Justice Kagan, probably Justice Jackson, maybe Justice Sotomayor, was sort of this maybe consequentialist approach to this statute, which is, well, how does it make any sense to read the statute to exclude from its scope devices that would allow you to achieve the same high rate of fire as, you know, a machine gun like the M16, for example, right? In their view, I think that seems like something of an absurd result, given the evidence about the National Firearms Act and what the congressional intent was there.
So it seemed like several conservatives were acknowledging that it's functioning like a machine gun. So Justices Barrett and Gorsuch said words to that effect. Then the buts came, and they both thought that this is something that Congress should do.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they thought that this is something Congress should do that cannot be accomplished through regulation. And I also think there was a strong view, you know, among some of the conservative justices, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, maybe Justice Alito, that they were very concerned about the potential confusion and the potential for sort of people who own these devices to be kind of almost trapped, right, and feel like, well, that they're not sure what the legal status is, and yet they could be prosecuted criminally for having these devices. And so a lot of concern about sort of what the practical impact of this rule would be on people who have owned bump stock devices at various points in time.
I thought that was a ridiculous concern. Would people be so confused if the ATF said bump stocks are now illegal? I mean, laws change. Ask the Supreme Court about abortion.
Maybe the key point here is that actually, I don't know how much this matters. And there were a few justices who pressed, you know, the government attorney on this issue. The government is not really bringing criminal prosecutions, as far as I know, of those who have possessed bump stock devices, right? And I would suspect that they wouldn't do that until this litigation sort of resolves. And certainly, this issue is not unique to bump stocks, right? Frequently, circuits disagree on various issues of criminal law, right? That doesn't mean that criminal penalties can't be invoked.
So what's your best guess as to how this will come out?
Again, this is not a Second Amendment case. It, of course, involves firearms and firearm accessories. But it's not a Second Amendment case, and that might initially lead one to think, well, maybe the justices will break down differently, right, than they have in their most recent Second Amendment decisions. After listening to the argument, I'm not so sure that's true. I think you can pretty confidently say that, you know, Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, they're probably on the side of the government here. Justice Alito, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Gorsuch, and probably Justice Thomas, I would guess, you know, seemed a little bit more sympathetic to Cargill's position. So then you have, of course, Justice Barrett and Chief Justice, who are sort of up in the air. And the Chief Justice didn't say a whole lot during oral arguments. Putting all that together, I expect this to be a very close case, potentially a 5-4 decision. I'm not really sure which way it will go. You have those same justices, Barrett and Roberts, that are kind of the key votes in the Second Amendment area, also being the key votes here.
Such an important case. Thanks, Andrew. That's Andrew Willinger, executive director of the Duke Center for Firearms Law. A note, Michael Bloomberg, the founder and majority owner of Bloomberg LP, the parent company of Bloomberg Radio, is a donor to groups that support gun control, including Everytown for Gun Safety. Now, while the justices were exhibiting division on the bench during oral arguments this week, two justices from opposite ends of the ideological spectrum appeared on stage side by side at the National Governors Association in D.C. last Friday to talk about how well the justices get along. But the main message from liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor and conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett seemed to be that the justices are not beholden to the presidents who appointed them.
And remember, thankfully for us, presidents don't last that long, right? There's 8 years. So for us to be beholden to one of them is a little crazy, you know?
It's not just that we're not Obama judges and Trump judges, but we're also not Democratic judges or Republican judges. We don't sit on opposite sides of an aisle. We all wear the same color black robe. We don't have red robes and blue robes.
Joining me is constitutional law expert David Super, a professor at Georgetown Law School. So was the point to tell the country that they get along and play well together or something else?
The point is to salvage the Supreme Court as a unifying institution, an institution relevant to all of us, and participating in that effort was one of the few things that Justice Sotomayor can do to make herself relevant, given how heavily outvoted she is.
The biggest message to me was that they're not beholden to the presidents that appointed them or to the president's party. Barrett said, we're not Obama judges or Trump judges. We're not Democratic judges or Republican judges. But she left out, we are liberal judges and conservative judges.
This is damage control for a court whose image has been badly harmed. You saw the same sort of thing in the early 2000s after Bush v. Gore, and some of the Democratic justices then, after several months had passed, started giving speeches that the court works well together and people should still respect the court. And I think after the damage that Dobbs and Gruen and some of these other high-profile cases, the affirmative action case, have done to the image of a court as an impartial finder of legal truth, that they feel some need to do this. Chief Justice Roberts has been doing it for a long time, and I suspect he's encouraged other justices to join in.
We'll see if the public's opinion of the court plummets any lower after this term's decisions on guns, the abortion pill, social media, and the like. Thanks so much, David. That's Professor David Super of Georgetown Law School. Coming up next, might Donald Trump be facing another lawsuit, this time over his new sneakers with those bright red soles? I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
That's the real deal. That's the real deal.
Donald Trump launched his Never Surrender high-top sneakers at SneakerCon last week, a limited edition selling for $399.
You know, I've wanted to do this for a long time. I have some incredible people that work with me on things, and they came up with this, and this is something I've been talking about for 12 years, 13 years, and I think it's going to be a big success.
It didn't take long for the garish gold sneakers with a stars and stripes design around the ankle and a huge letter T on the side to be mocked, including a skit on Saturday Night Live.
In terms of basketball movie pastiche and with regard to shoes, I think we've done a wonderful
job. White men can Trump.
But it's the bright red soles on the sneakers that have lawyers talking. Is luxury brand Christian Louboutin, known for its iconic red soles, going to sue for trademark infringement? Joining me is Susan Scafidi, director of the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham Law School. So these Never Surrender high-top sneakers, which are gold, Trump's favorite color apparently, but with those bright red soles, screams, I'm a Christian Louboutin sneaker.
Yes, it does. And I have a feeling that maybe there were a few trademark lawyers who had a hand in this shoe because it screams Louboutin, but then pulls back a little bit and says, yes, I'm Louboutin, but not quite. In part, because the Louboutin trademark as registered is actually for women's shoes only. Also, you see the way on the side of the Trump shoe, the red outsole bleeds up a little bit onto the white foxing along the side of the shoe. And I think that's because in the landmark lawsuit, when Yves Saint Laurent and Louboutin were in court together here in New York, the trademark ultimately ended up being modified. Now, that trademark was about an all-red shoe with a red upper and a red outsole that Yves Saint Laurent had done. But the ultimate result of that lawsuit was that the Louboutin trademark was modified so that there must be a contrast between the outsole and the upper. So maybe some clever trademark lawyer thought, well, if the red bleeds over a little bit, we could at least argue that there's not contrast. And we could argue that the registration is technically for women's, although that's not really smart thinking because, of course, there's a common law trademark in the U.S. And since Louboutin is so associated with red soles on shoes, including now for men's, including his own, even though at the time that he originally registered in the U.S., he did very few men's, I think that Louboutin, if it cared to take action, would in fact have a pretty good case.
And Nike might also be looking at these Trump sneakers?
Well, you know, Louboutin is the first glaring trademark reference, shall we say, and a reference to luxury in those shoes. But, you know, the silhouette is an awful lot like the Nike Air Force One. nudge wink, Air Force One.
Oh. Right?
So there's a lot going on here. And while Nike does have trade dress registration on some elements of the Air Force One, including the Air Force One high tops that these resemble, I again think there might have been a trademark lawyer in the design room saying, you know, maybe move those panels just a little bit. Maybe don't do too many vertical lines down along the base of the foxing at the bottom of the shoe just before it touches the ground. Maybe make sure you don't use the wavy leather brackets that hold the eyelets for the shoelaces that are so classic and associated with the Nike Air Force One. And yet, for a sneaker aficionado, looking at that silhouette, it does have that reference, especially because the flag-like imagery around the top also feels like a reference to the band around the top of an Air Force One. So overall, I can't imagine that Nike would be happy. They wouldn't necessarily have quite as strong a trademark claim as Louboutin, but I think that certainly it crossed a desk at Nike, the desk in the legal department.
The little differences, let's say the way the red goes up the side, do those make that much of a difference in a lawsuit? Because most people just look, oh, it's got a red sole.
Well, it moves us from the realm of a straight up counterfeit where we have something that is nearly or substantially identical to the realm of potential infringement. But because there is that generalized test in trademark, is there a likelihood of consumer confusion? Might some consumers think that this was a deal between Donald Trump and Louboutin? That test for consumer confusion is what will control. And I think a consumer could absolutely be confused as to whether or not this was a licensed product or whether or not perhaps even Louboutin was endorsing Trump, which of course could be very controversial, both for the company itself and for the designer himself, but also for consumers who love their Loubis.
And apparently some social media users were commenting on Instagram. One said, please, please, please sue Donald Trump for infringing on your Red Sole trademark. Another said, you licensed your trademark Red Sole to that wannabe blank.
It's the comment about licensing that is of more concern, right? Sue him does not show consumer confusion. Hey, how dare you license to him is of more concern from a legal perspective. And you know, there is an instance in the past when Christian Louboutin went after a right-wing Belgian politician, a woman who was wearing his red soles regularly, but most importantly, for purposes of his complaint, on posters and ads that were targeting Muslim immigrants to Belgium. In that case, it was the actual Louboutin product showing up in her political ads and in her political statements. And so it was an even closer connection. Still, he seems to have been willing to wade into a fight before in a case in which a politician tried to associate with the Red Soles without his permission.
So that would be a business decision whether or not you want to go after Trump and possibly get the backlash that people who go after Trump often do. But on the other hand, do you want your shoes associated with Trump?
Absolutely. At one level, it's a trademark decision. You don't want your red sole to just become a generic indicator of luxury, a shorthand for a designer product. And so from a trademark perspective, to avoid becoming generic, you do have to engage in a certain amount of policing. But yes, at the level of a business decision, you have to decide, do you dare offend Trump supporters, or are you more concerned about Trump opponents starting to boycott your shoe if they believe that there's a connection? And there's these additional concern in terms of a business decision of how much attention do you want to draw to these sneakers that were apparently a limited edition one and done. If you think he might do it again, maybe you're more likely to file a lawsuit or at least send a cease and desist letter. But if you think it might just be a quick hit in the media and something that disappears from the public consciousness, do you want to be the entity keeping those red soles in the public consciousness, therefore underscoring the association between your brand and the politician?
What does Louboutin lose if they don't sue over the sneakers? Does their mark get watered down?
Sure. There's a potential for dilution of the mark. That is to say, now when we see a red sole, we automatically think Louboutin. Or do we think, well, it could be Louboutin or it could be Trump? And that's the key to dilution. So they worry about dilution of the strength of that mark. And they worry about, ultimately, if they allow this one and the next one to happen, the Redsole mark actually becoming generic and the mark actually dying. We refer to the concept of genericide, right? Becoming generic can kill a mark because it's no longer serving as a source indicator to consumers. It's no longer a red flag telling consumers, hey, this is, in the best possible way, a red flag. This is definitely a Louboutin because you see the Redsole.
Let's say Louboutin does sue. Would it be for trademark infringement or trademark dilution?
It could be for both, trademark infringement and trademark dilution.
And who do you think would have the better case in court? I mean, is there a chance that Louboutin could lose?
There's always a chance. You never know what you're going to get going into court. On the other hand, Louboutin has a very solid footprint with this trademark. And so I think that in a kickboxing match with these shoes, I would think that Louboutin may very well come out on top.
I assume it also just doesn't want to be associated with that garish, clunky gold sneaker.
In terms of reputational concern, yes, you absolutely don't want to be associated with something that you find distasteful, not only because of the individual it might be associated with, but because of the style itself or lack thereof. They are indeed quite dramatic.
You're so nice to put it that way, Susan.
Well, then there's the question of the quasi-flag iconography as well, which actually is an interesting problem because the U.S. has law on the books about disrespect or disparagement of the flag. Technically, you're not supposed to use the flag in advertising. In fact, the trademark office won't register a trademark that includes the flag. Now, obviously, there's not actually a flag on the shoes, just a nod to the flag with a handful of stars and stripes. But even though First Amendment law has, oh my goodness, for the last 50 years, prevented enforcement of any kind of law that would penalize anyone for putting a flag on clothing or putting a flag on shoes where it might be dirtied or damaged or otherwise disparaged. Nevertheless, you're walking a fine line when you decide to put a flag or something that looks like a flag somewhere that might be considered disrespectful.
So do you think that Louboutin will at least send a cease and desist letter?
I would hope so. Unfortunately, one of the concerns for Louboutin is if Louboutin sends a cease and desist letter, it will immediately be posted. And so it comes back to the question of, do we think Trump will do this again? Or do we think Trump's licensee will do this again? And how much attention do we want to draw to this if it was indeed a one and done at SneakerCon?
The company has left itself an out because purchasers of the sneakers may not actually get Redsole sneakers when their order arrives in July. On the website, it says the images shown are for illustration purposes only and may not be an exact representation of the product. So that leaves them room to get rid of the Redsoles.
It does. Now, if they were to do that, and particularly if they were forced to do that via legal action, I think some consumers would be upset because they're not getting what was pictured and what was promised. That's not a minor change. That's a significant stylistic change. But nevertheless, they have indeed left themselves technically a legal out. But of course, if the purpose of these sneakers is in part to court your audience and to court the audience of sneakerheads, a young, male, more urban audience, then you absolutely don't want to undermine that essentially advertising or campaign effort by making your customers angry when they receive the shoes. You don't want lots of negative publicity following on the initial release of the shoe.
Thanks so much, Susan. It's always an informative and fun conversation. That's Susan Scafidi, a professor at Fordham Law School and director of the Fashion Law Institute. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.